Cookie is one person that comes to mind,
Yeah.
and when you were doing your work in Mississippi. But can you just talk a little bit about, again, this math literacy advocacy, this strong imperative, this strong method of empowerment, and what does it mean to really relate and reach young people?
Yeah. Well, first you need to open your heart, your homes, your space to young people. And when I went to Mississippi, a lot of the work was really just becoming big brothers, becoming father-like figures to young people. And so Sammy or Cookie is one of the young people who, every school in America would write him off. And, they would expect nothing of him. And really, there were policies to get folks like him out of the building. And so those were the young people that my dad wanted to make sure the Algebra Project met where they were at and tried to work for them. And so my dad often talked about, raising the floor of math literacy. And so looking at, how do we raise the floor so that all young people are able to kind of to make it through? And so, the things we did was really we spent a lot of time with young people outside of school to build trust, to build relationships, to earn the respect of their parents, their family and community members. And, our first thing was challenging them to do better in school and to really be invested in their own education. But then thinking about how we can extend it beyond that and how can we think about things that we can do together that enable us to, make the system work better for other young people and also potentially become conscientious of and challenge some of the things within the system that create this situation where folks like Sammy are disregarded and are expected to
Sammy being
fail.
Cookie, just for our listeners. That was his
Yeah,
nickname.
yeah.
Sammy's nickname was Cookie. Yeah. Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Omar Moses. He's an activist, an educator, and a media maker. He's the CEO and founder of Math Talk. And we're basically talking about, through his memoir, The White Peril, his family's legacy and dedication to advocating for justice for Black communities, but particularly young people, through again the engagement of math. Mr. Moses, I again want to thank you. I also want to thank the group of educators, Teaching for Change, for having you come into the area, bringing you to my attention. And I'd like to acknowledge that. Also, I had the privilege a few years ago to interview your father, and of course knew him for his math advocacy. This book is complete with all sorts of reasons why you do what you do, but tell us about why Mississippi, why, what were the particulars of feeling that you and your brother and then later your sister had to go there and extend your father's work.
I mean, Mississippi has been such a huge part of our family story. And so my mom and dad met in Mississippi. And really, you couldn't know my dad unless you were in Mississippi with him. And so much of his life, his formative years were spent in Mississippi, and so much of who he became was connected to Mississippi. And so it was really an honor to be in Mississippi with him. And, we all went there for different reasons. And so my dad wanted to keep him off the streets. I went to Mississippi at a time when my basketball journey had ended and I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And so it was a place for me to find my purpose. And Maisha, my older sister, she came there to be with us and to be our older sister and make sure we did, what we were supposed to do. And so, we were all there. It was a wonderful opportunity. to begin to understand like the deep level of respect at the people level that folks had for my dad and his work. And also to learn, you know, the way he moved. And a lot of what he did was just, again, just meeting folks where they're at, a lot of conversations, a lot of trying to get people to share their stories, their thoughts, their ideas, and to introduce them to the importance of math and to make the connection to the work that he was doing now with the Algebra Project and the work that he had done with folks in the 60s. And so it was just, it was wonderful to be there to see how he was able to galvanize classrooms of students, entire schools and community members, just to be invested in their young people in a different way. And so, you know, we were all able to be a part of that. And I think that's just shaped our lives and how we move, you know? And so when I think about who we are and what we do, you know, we're all organizers. I think we lead generally from the back, but we lead. And I think everything that we do, there's this sense of how can we do it in a way that with people, but also how can we do it in a way that it's impactful for future generations.
Well, like your father, you demonstrate through your memoir that it's a very delicate and precious paying attention to individuals and understanding that in our humanity, you know, personal aspirations, personal ambitions, personal goals are you know, it's, if not our center, it's a matter of great gravity to us. Mm-hmm. But the other part of that is that even though we're individuals, there's a collective sense of being. And I find in your sharing in your memoir that you honor that work. Your father certainly did. Your great-grandfather certainly did. And if you could just talk further about how that translates for Black youth that you dealt with.
Yeah.
Understanding their importance as individuals, but understanding collectivity as well.
Yeah. And I think it's part of, you know, African consciousness. I think it's this idea of the village and the community and the individual rises, you know, within the context of a whole community, and they're part of the community and they're never bigger than the community. And so when I think about it, I think about the ways in which, you know, my dad organized the classroom and, you know, everyone had a voice and he wanted to make sure that, you know, everyone had an opportunity to speak and that every voice in the classroom was just as important as any other voice. And, you know, thinking about ways in which folks can try to come to some kind of consensus about something. And so I think about like just that at a practical level to these larger kind of more metaphorical ideas of, you know, the movement or SNCC being a wave in a much larger ocean of movement. And so again, you know, how can you have a practice that is enabling people to be part of a larger conversation? And how do you think about activism and action from the perspective of this being part of, you know, a generational struggle and movement and people contributing their lives, giving their lives to trying to make things better for their kids, but also for future generations. And so we're all inheritors of that. And so I think the book tries to make that connection on a familial level between my great-grandfather, my father, and myself, my mother, and her ancestors, but also on a movement level. And so bringing in the voices of Amzi Moore and his perspective as a way to give people a sense of just the way, the deep activism that was rooted in Mississippi before the Freedom Riders came into Mississippi. And so, you know, they were picking up off of or building off of energy and building off of work that folks have been doing for a while. And so, yeah, I think we're all inheriting, you know, on a personal level, you know, I'm inheriting my dad's memories, my great grandfather's memories, all these memories. But we're also inheriting the work and the contributions and the sacrifices that people have made for us to be here.
And you're also demonstrating the Sankofa principle, reaching back to bring, I'm going to add, good things forward.
Yes.
But I think, and we're coming up on our break, but in your memoir, it's clear that young people appreciate this for themselves. Even the simple things of performance or the math tournaments or the flyway competitions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just sheer fun for fun's sake. It's conjoined with that they really appreciate and know that they need to support each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's I've been a basketball fan. It's a team sport, you know, and you got to understand, as good as LeBron James is, as good as Michael Jordan was, you know, you can't win without your teammates and the different roles that people can play. And, you know, people, us as individuals, you know, part of being human or the human experience is, you know, really understanding your own purpose, the things that you're passionate about and being able to pursue those things. But continuing to understand, particularly with Black folks, is that you're doing that within just, you know, an amazing legacy of struggle. To allow us to be able to pursue those things, you know? And so I think the book tries to convey that.
And again, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But importantly, you just heard Omar Moses, who's an activist, educator, and media maker around math, its empowerment that it gives to people. And he's talking about the company of not only he and his family have served. Why don't you stick with us, listeners, and as a service to you, we're going to bring you some public service.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Welcome back to We the People, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I'm your host for this hour. I join 80-plus other programmers in bringing you Jazz and Justice because listeners like yourself choose to support this Jazz and Justice radio station, Pacifica Foundation Radio, at 50,000 watts strong through the airwaves, but also through the internet and also other social media platforms, whether it's iTunes or other media platforms. We bring you Jazz and Justice in an attempt to build better communities one broadcast at a time. And we only do that through your support, both financial and social. So I thank you for that. Our guest today is Omar Moses. He's notably an activist and educator working with the discipline of math for young people and everyone, particularly in marginalized or neglected communities. And we're talking about his family legacy their dedication to education, their use of mathematics and education and life broadly to, again, empower young people and everyone. Mr. Moses, thank you again for being with us. We're here on the airways right now, but my understanding is tomorrow it's at 14th and V Streets Northwest at 6 p.m. Talking about this memoir of yours, The White Peril. And again, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. So we were talking about your great-grandfather, your parents, but and their family and friends. So there are at least two or three things that I want to cover and have you share with our audience. And that is how your mom and your dad facilitated not only knowing SNCC compatriots, but knowing people and wherever the communities they were. Feel free to tell us more about Tanzania, about the neighborhood you grew up in, Cambridge, if you please. But let's start with, who are some of the folks you were introduced to that you found important, both in your formative years and also with the work you do now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Uncle Charlie Cobb, you know, Fred Mangrum, there's so many people, you know, from Curtis to Hollis to Cortland Cox, Chuck McDougall to Julian. June Johnson was someone that, you know, would, she'd bring her child, Hakeem, and he'd spend summers with us. And so there was just a community of folks who they had struggled with Mississippi that, you know, would just come through, or their kids would come through. And we understood that we were part of a family of people that had committed their lives to trying to challenge and change this country. In addition to that, growing up in Cambridge, you know, there was a community of Black families, you know, that kind of wrapped their arms around each other's children. And so it felt like we were growing up in a village. There were, you know, so many things that they did to just insulate us and to make us feel loved and to make us feel like we were safe. And so that was important. And then, you know, my dad, you know, he grew up in the Harlem River houses, and he wanted to make sure that his sons in particular understood what it meant to be a Black man in America from the perspective of, you know, what most Black men have to confront and experience. And so when he won a MacArthur Award, he purchased a home near the Newtown Court housing projects. And so, you know, my friends and the folks that really helped to define my identity became, you know, the young brothers and that we grew up with that lived in the projects. And so what it was to look from that vantage point out onto America and to think about, you know, who you could be and what was possible for you from that perspective.
You mentioned sons, and you had several siblings, but importantly, you were very close to your brother, Taba, and he also was very gifted in many, many ways. I want to mention the athletics, but there's more to it than that. You two were adventurers in Cambridge. So I'm going to ask a whole bunch of questions right away. You demonstrated that your parents trusted other dear ones to give you both guidance as well as your sisters. And let me see how I can put this. How did you understand then and understand now what was going on with you? You and your brother were blessed with a sense of abandon and adventure and pursuing athletics. But how did you sense the guidance, even beyond your parents, beyond your communities? People who read your book will find you keenly observant about the environment you were growing up in.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, you know, it's one thing looking back and having that vantage point to be able to try to capture the physical landscape that we were moving through. As kids, we were just moving through it. And, you know, I mean, one of the beauties in Cambridge was that, you know, if you had a bike, then the city was yours. You know, all you needed was a bike. And, you know, literally you could roam and you felt like, you know, the city was. And so Tyler, you know, he's a little over than a year younger than me, but we've just been extremely close. And so I always felt like, you know, probably he was the closest person to me. And, you know, it was always me and him just going out and discovering the world and being confronted by it, and came together and we would make it through stuff. Other ways, you know, we went in different directions, but it was just that bond that we had growing up as brothers close in age. And I wanted to try to capture that, but also show how that extended to the brothers that we grew up with in Newtown Court, how we developed similar brotherhood, and how that is really important for young men, young Black men in particular, just to have that strong peer group and to feel like, you know, you're moving this together with the group of folks. And so, you know, I think there were a lot of influences during that time. Like, we grew up and, you know, it was like the dawn of hip hop. And I'll never forget, my mom would always be like, oh man, we get the records and we come home and play the records. Or in those days, you know, they play hip hop music on the radio station, and we'd have the tape recorder and we'd try and record the songs while it was being played. But I remember my mom saying, oh man, that music isn't gonna last. You know, it's just, you know, like it was a fluke. But it became the dominant cultural form, you know? And so growing up, you know, at a time where hip hop is emerging and, you know, in the book, I try to think about hip hop music is freedom music, you know? So we grew up on freedom songs and we understood like the power of that music in enabling people to actualize something different in their lives. And so, well, that's how we experienced hip hop. You know, it was like this liberating music that was channeling what we were experiencing, that enabled us to challenge what we were experiencing. And so
it's a deeper understanding of creativity and what it means to inside an individual, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, I tried to just think about, you know, us as young men, and, you know, we're part of this emerging kind of cultural phenomenon. And, you know, it's defining, it's helping to shape our identities and our perception of manhood, in some ways that are good, in some ways that are bad, you know, in some ways that challenge the society, but also in some ways that reflect like the dominant society. And so I felt like, you know, a lot of those things are relevant today. And so I wanted to try to reflect on that, particularly think about kids and, like, what is my son going to have to wrestle with, you know? And what is he going to have to really make sense of to give him an understanding of, a real understanding of, you know, who he is and you know, what this place is that we're growing up in. So, you know, we're living in an age where, you know, you don't have to touch reality, you know, and kind of experience life in this virtual, digital kind of misinformed way. And so when we grew up, you know, we were running this, you know, you had to, things were real and tangible. And so part of the goal is to just share that, you know, in a way that I think, and in a way that shows how it shaped us, but also in a way that I think hopefully for kids today, it can give them a different sense of, you know, I guess it's hard to describe. I mean, it can give them a sense of, you know, at a minimal level, it'll give them a sense of everything that they're consuming. This is kind of where it came from.
Yeah, you know, it's from Tanzania. What is it that, and your brother Taba only experienced that later in life, right? If I'm not mistaken, you and not everybody, not all your siblings were there initially. What is it that the experience in Tanzania offered you, and in turn offers us through your memoir?
Yeah, it offers a reference point for our humanity that begins outside of America, and begins beyond or outside of this narrative that tries to define like who we are and who we're supposed to be.
And in some ways you become an ambassador for that. That's not the best phrase, forgive me. But you know, the generalization is that young people often don't have those experiences outside of their immediate neighborhood. And neither, I dare I say, does an educational system that exists within the status quo encourages that.
Yeah. I mean, I could see how, you know, when I worked in the algebra project and worked with the young people in Mississippi, it was just so important for me to like take trips with the young people from Mississippi through the South, but up to the North. We went to Canada and, you know, they went to California. And when I talk to them today, they just talk about how those experiences outside of the confines of their daily lives help them imagine themselves or dream of things that they hadn't necessarily dreamt of. So think about my attempt to, you know, go back to the memories that were just so rich and impactful of myself at an early age, and think about just how it's important to be able to see yourselves beyond the boundaries that by which others are trying to define you. And so I think that's just a natural part of the Black struggle in America, is that, you know, folks are trying to define who you are and who you're supposed to be, and you're trying to confront that definition. And so where do you start? And so for me, I was blessed that, well, I can imagine myself beyond, before I became Black in America. And so who was I? What was that like? And how does that relate to who I am now and what I've experienced in this country?
At one point in your book, you say, and then what? And then how does one thing lead to another? That latter question often was, you were reminded by your mother that one thing mm-hmm. does lead to another. And then earlier you mentioned some people. You mentioned June Johnson, who was a compatriot of Fannie Lou Hamer. And she was with, they were both jailed and brutalized and beaten in jail. She's also an important leader in the work that your father and SNCC people did in voting registration efforts, obviously. You mentioned, and this won't do justice, there's some important everyday people who are extraordinary. And I tried to put together that phrase carefully, but Amzi Moore is an important example of courage, and Charlie Cobb, who wrote Radical Equations with your dad, again, Bob Moses. Can you just tell us a bit more about these people, if you please?
Yeah. Well, again, the first thing was that they embraced us like we were their children. So every time I saw them and met them, you know, you really just felt the love, and you felt like, you know, you were responsible to them in some ways, and they were responsible to you. And so, in thinking about June Johnson in particular, you know, I think it would be amazing when she and my dad would reconnect, and they just kind of go off into these conversations about Mississippi and things, experience and things that they did together. And so it was just a kinship, and bond of brotherhood and sisterhood. And one of the things my dad was challenging us to do, particularly in Mississippi, he'd always say, you know, the young people need to get their act together. And he understood just the power and the necessity of young people to be part of any movement and to be part of challenging, you know, the status quo. And so, you know, what we've tried to do is really try to create space for young people to think about, like, what is our work today? You know, what are we being confronted with? What do we need to be able to confront both individually as people, but also collectively? And so I think, you know, those lessons, whether it's from Ella Baker, and, you know, I'm going to botch the quote, but she would just talk about radical change. And, you know, in order to achieve radical change, one of the first things you need to do is to understand who you are, where you've come from. And so it wasn't about, you know, let's just go out and change something, but it's really about, you know, how do we understand who we are? How do we understand where we've come from? And how do we utilize that in a way that it can challenge and change what we're confronted with?
Yeah, you refer to Ella Baker, and your book does capture an important quote by her: "What I do is supposed to speak louder than what I say."
Yeah.
And it's very reflective of the selflessness in the contrast your father, Bob Moses, also made about there's a difference in being a leader and being an organizer, and they're not mutually exclusive, but sometimes the practices have a subtle and important difference. And I would say that in many, many unfathomable ways that can't be expressed in words, Ella Baker was a true organizer. She could have easily moved into a position of celebrity and notoriety, yet what was important to her is what SNCC would continue to do. Allow me to reintroduce you one more time and do some house care here. Omo Moses. Omo Moses, the son of Robert Moses. And importantly, in his own right, he's an educator, activist, and media maker. Along with his father and his family's legacy in education, he embraces math as just one of the many ways that young people can come of age, have their own agency, encourage one another, and build better communities. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Moses. I need to be mindful of time here, and there's so much here to go along with, and maybe we should return to this. One thing is related to another. What people say and do leave us a legacy, and maybe what's important too is a sense that the personal or the intimate, particularly among family members, can lead to benefit with the community. And I'm thinking of some of the transcripts that you share in your book from your father. And we talked about the organizing principle and the leadership principle, but I think he had a simple illustration which often models some of the physicality of the algebra project, and that is an ocean and a wave. I wonder if you can explain that to the listeners.
Yeah. You know, my dad, it's amazing because You know, my dad would talk about that when we were working in the algebra project, just this idea that, you know, you're in a movement. Then I was writing, I saw how he talked about that as a member of SNCC, to talk to as a way for SNCC to think about itself and its work. And so there's an interview in the book that he gave to C-SPAN, which talked about, which was characterizing King's role in the movement. And so, you know, it was powerful to see how important he felt it was to really use that metaphor as really a reference, as a way to think about movement. And I think part of what he was just saying was that, you know, one is a continuous struggle. And if you think of yourself as a wave in an ocean of movement, you know, you're just part of this continuous struggle. And, you know, there's no way to think about the wave without thinking about, without the context of the ocean, without the context of full movement. And so he was saying, there's no way to think about movement. You know, he's part of this ocean. And so I think what it invites young people, because young people, we can't become king, but we can become, and we can become part of the wave, and we can contribute, you know, to movement. And so I think he was always thinking about, you know, this is something, movement doesn't happen without people, without everyday folks, without young people. And so we need to have ways of thinking and talking about movement, which encourages them to participate, which helps them see kind of their necessity and essentialness and actually creating that movement. And so, you know, I think he was really clear about that. And I wanted to just try to communicate that and let it sit, you know, clearly, you know, his words, his perspective, and to let that sit next to kind of his work. And so I think that was just a rich opportunity for me to take how he was thinking about his work and their work, and then to have that kind of bookend, you know, his first person perspective of the work as he was in Mississippi.
Well, we've come to pretty much the conclusion of this hour with you, and I thank you for being with us. Omo Moses, the author of The White Pearl, a memoir of his life, his family's life, and the legacy and work that they're creating for us. I thank you for that. I know, again, that you'll be at Bus Boys and Poets, 14th and V Street Northwest, tomorrow at 6 p.m., talking about the importance of math education, education in general, talking about this memoir, ensuring the treasure of your family and the work of both your mother and your dad, your father being Bob Moses of the Algebra Project. In my thanks to you, I want to acknowledge something that you pointed out toward the conclusion of your book, that we live in each other's dreams. Our striving, our ambitions, our aspirations are interconnected. And with that, I thank you for your work. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up next is the news from our News and Public Affairs Department. I'd like to thank my engineer, Mike Nasella. At the noon hour during the week, don't forget The Blues, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. At 1 p.m. African Now with host Moesa Mutale. And I thank you, the listeners, for being with us and supporting WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station. Take good care, and perhaps we'll meet again on the radio. Take care.
leaves us to our tears. More, lawmakers cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. We shall not stand down. We'll not be your clown. All the flame burning bright. Who perilous night.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WPFW program